I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome to my show. Walk down any New York street on a garbage pickup day, and you're likely to see an old TV or a computer next to the garbage cans. What happens to those old electronics once they've been put into a landfill? Well, with me now is Ted Smith, founder of the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition, a group that researches environmental and human health problems caused by the rapid growth of the high-tech electronics industry. And I'm very pleased to welcome him to my show. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
What do we use in our everyday lives that contain toxic components?
Well, virtually every electronic product, which means anything that has a circuit board or a semiconductor chip, is in fact a toxic product. And I think this is still quite shocking to people, although here in Silicon Valley we discovered this more than 25 years ago when we discovered that we had a highly polluted groundwater basin from the manufacturing of these products. Since that time, the problem has just continued to grow.
So it's not just computers, TVs, cell phones, iPods. It can also be a microwave and maybe a programmable coffee machine?
The whole thing. The point is that if it has a circuit board in it, it's got lead solder, because up until very recently, all solder in circuit boards contained lead. Luckily, we can maybe get to this a little bit later, that there's some legislation in Europe which is helping to change that. But right now, virtually all products on the market that are electronic in any kind of way contain at least lead, and oftentimes other kinds of pretty nasty substances like cadmium and brominated flame retardants and mercury.
Well, how much lead are we talking about in a typical TV set or in a computer monitor?
Well, the traditional kinds of monitors and televisions, which they call the cathode ray tube, the CRT, has several pounds of lead in the glass. A 25-inch screen might have as much as 5 or 6 pounds of lead mixed into the glass, and people will say, well, what in the world is that for? And the reason is that a cathode ray tube is shooting electron rays out through the screen. That's how the technology works. And if it weren't for the lead, we'd all be irradiated. It's like when you go to a dentist's office and they put a lead apron on you when they take x-rays. The newer technology, the flat panels, is a different technology, so they're not shooting rays out at you. But still, a flat panel, they all today use mercury as a way of exciting the pixels on your screen. So we're trading lead for mercury.
And the equally poisonous.
Oh, mercury has been known, and both of them have been known for, you know, thousands of years as being really serious problems in the environment.
Is there any estimation as to how many personal computers and TVs are discarded each year in the United States?
It's millions. Nobody knows for sure because the government doesn't even bother to count them. But the best estimates are that somewhere around 500 million computers alone in the U.S. Will have been discarded by later this year from the beginning of the computer revolution. So half a billion is the number that is the traditional estimate. And that's, as I say, just computers and just in the U.S. If you add TVs, it more than doubles it, because certainly more households have televisions and it's a much older technology. And if you look globally, my guess is it's probably over a billion around the world have been discarded since the beginning of this revolution.
I had a very nice television set that developed a buzz, and I tried to have it repaired. I couldn't find anybody who would repair it anymore. It used to be TV stores, repair stores all over. So I had no choice but to throw it out.
That's one of the real problems, is that the obsolescence, and then televisions, you know, last a pretty long time. I suppose yours probably lasted several years, I would hope.
Oh, it was an older TV, but
yeah.
Still it was perfectly fine.
Yeah.
I would have repaired it if I could. Sometimes if you can find a repair person, you discover that it costs almost as much to repair it as to replace it.
And that's the problem, too, particularly with some of the smaller electronic products, is that the cost of repair is oftentimes more, as you say, than the cost of replacement. So we've really developed a throwaway culture. And not only that it's a throwaway culture, it's a toxic throwaway culture. And when you put those two things together, it's a really serious problem.
So we're being offered incentives to throw out the older models.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, that's part of the whole strategy of the companies that make these products, is that they want to sell more. And so if they make a product that becomes obsolete in a short period of time, then they increase their chances of selling another product. So that's very good for their bottom line. It's just that it's not very good for the environment.
We probably haven't seen many discarded iPods yet, since most people got them for Christmas just 6 months ago. But let's look at some of the problems they may create.
Yeah, and iPods are, it's very similar to cell phones. Because they're so small, when they break down, when the battery gives out, or when maybe the circuitry goes bad, or maybe just when you want to buy the next generation, the tendency of people is to just toss them. And it's very easy to just put it in the trash and, you know, kind of wash your hands and say goodbye. The problem is, again, that an iPod, just like a cell phone, has these circuits in it that contain lead, that there's also in many of these products components called brominated flame retardants, and these are things that are known to be very toxic also. They're used as plastic additives to make sure that the products don't burn in a fire, but at the same time, these are the kinds of materials that are showing up in people's breast milk now all around the world as a contaminant because they're so ubiquitous in our lives. So it's really important to try to not only help people understand that it's really not a helpful thing to throw these products out, it's also really important to try to get the companies who make these toxic products to start adopting the procedures that are coming in Europe and other parts of the world where they really take responsibility for the full life cycle of their products.
Earlier this year, I read an article about a study that found that a toxic chemical used in rocket fuel was found in pretty much every sample taken of nursing mother's milk in the United States.
Yeah.
That's rocket fuel. So that's just from the fallout of rockets?
Yeah. We have a situation here just south of San Jose where the material you're talking about is found in the groundwater from old manufacturing sites down there. And there's many, many notorious sites throughout the West. I hadn't heard of the ones on the East, but I know that, you know, ever since the beginning of the Cold War, really, with the tremendous focus on building rocket technology, again, we were in such a hurry that people weren't paying attention to the way they were handling these materials. And they've gotten out ubiquitously into the environment.
Is there a way of removing rocket fuel from the groundwater?
Well, there is, but it's very expensive. The way that we discovered our toxic problems here in Silicon Valley was precisely through the discovery of groundwater contamination. In this case, it wasn't rocket fuel. It was the solvents used in manufacturing the chips and the circuit boards. And the companies have had to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in cleaning up this mess. They have to pump out the groundwater and filter it and then put it back into the groundwater. So it's an enormously expensive lesson. And one of the, you know, side benefits of this, if you want to look at it that way, is that a lot of the companies did learn a very difficult lesson, which is that it's a lot more expensive to clean up a mess after you've created it than it is to simply prevent it in the first place. And of course, that's what we want to be able to encourage.
Of course, then you have to get government to actually enforce those rules,
well,
which has been another issue.
Yeah.
What about the batteries in cell phones, iPods? Are they also toxic?
Most of them are, yeah. There's a variety of batteries that are being used, but most of them have either cadmium, which is another known toxic, which is another material that's on the phase-out list in the European laws, but also there's lithium that's used, and we've had some pretty notorious problems here and again in Silicon Valley involving lithium, which, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, at some points can actually have a medicinal value, but if it's in quantities that are the kind of quantities that you sometimes find in batteries, it can have a very negative health impact. So the battery technology, which is increasingly, again, found in so many products, is still very problematic, and there's a fair amount of research going on trying to find a less toxic battery and one that will last longer, but we still have enormous problems on that, which is just another reason why we have to encourage take-back by the companies that make these products.
Now, cadmium also is used in oil paints, cadmium red, for example, cadmium yellow, the best colors. Lithium, as you mentioned, is used in medicines, especially with people who are bipolar.
Right.
Are they also problems? What happens when paint tubes are thrown out? What happens?
Well, a lot of artists have discovered that some of these paints, and pretty, as you say, the pigments that can, you know, help create really brilliant colors are some of the most problematic, and a lot of artists are finding alternative paints that are not toxic. But a lot of people still don't realize that this is part of the whole system, and sure, a lot of those old paints have been thrown out and have just gotten into the waste stream. And you mentioned earlier the concern about landfills. There's really a couple of concerns, but landfills are certainly one of them, and we know from, you know, unfortunate history that eventually all landfills leak. And again, the concern is that these chemicals will get into our groundwater. But also a lot of these old things are being burned right now in incinerators or in cement kilns or sometimes what people call waste-to-energy systems, where once you put toxic products into them, you get toxic products out, whether it's in the ash or the air emissions. So again, the lesson, I think, is that it's a lot more important to prevent this kind of pollution at the first place, to encourage much better design for the environment by the manufacturers so that we don't have to keep playing catch-up at the waste end.
What about some of the other things that have come along recently? I've started using these bleach wipes to clean up the kitchen. Used to use an old rag that I would wash out and use again. Now these are so much more convenient. Or what about plastic shower curtains or vinyl siding or weed killers, for that matter? Are they also contain chemicals we should be worrying about?
Oh, of course. And actually, there's a number of groups around the country that have developed pretty good curriculum on how to reduce the toxicity in your own household. You mentioned a few of the ones that are of concern. The vinyl, the plastic that's used in what we typically call vinyl is polyvinyl chloride. That's one of the nastiest substances known. It's actually a waste byproduct from the manufacture of chlorine. And when burned, those materials create dioxin, which is the deadliest substance ever known. So there's a whole vast movement all around the world, really, to try to encourage the phase-out of vinyl products.
Are there many scientific studies going on to assess the dangers of these things?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's an awful lot of research that has gone on. It's a little bit like the whole debate that people are probably more familiar with around global warming, is that there's, you know, overwhelming research in a number of these areas showing that these products are very toxic, and particularly when you're talking about some of the older, more well-established ones like lead and mercury. But you still have people, particularly people who are trying to defend their industry markets, who will say, oh, the research isn't perfect, or there's still a hole here or there. And the debate is really the same. You know, do we wait for 100% conclusive evidence, and by that time we'll all have this stuff in our bodies, or do you take action at a time when it's still possible to prevent further harm? And people increasingly are beginning to call that the precautionary approach, that when we want to be able to encourage precautionary action, even in the absence of 100% scientific proof, because as we've seen again from the global warming debate, trying to get 100% proof, you know, we'll all be underwater by then.
Well, can we contain these toxins from e-waste in the ways that we contain nuclear waste in containers that, at least in theory, will not break open, will not leach into the environment?
Yeah, there are ways that we can do that. That's probably more extreme than what we really need to do right now. Right now, there is a growing infrastructure for recycling the e-waste. And, you know, there's still a lot of valuable materials in there that can be reused if we can figure out how to separate them. But before we even talk about that, let me just mention that a much better way of dealing with obsolete electronics is trying to find a reuse.
Well, let's hold off on that and get into recycling and reuse after we take a little break.
Okay.
I'm Leonard Lopate, and my guest is Ted Smith, founder of the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition, a group that researches environmental and human health problems caused by the rapid growth of the high-tech electronics industry. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Ted Smith, founder of the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition. We're talking about what happens when the new technologies get thrown away and create more toxic waste. And I was thinking when I mentioned that our show is now being podcast, and of course all radio shows are now available on the Internet, whether I haven't become part of the problem rather than the solution.
Well, I think that's a good question. I think it's something that you know, those of us who've been working on this issue for a long time ask ourselves probably every day. I mean, we are all addicted to the technology. I think we have to acknowledge that. And in that sense, I think it really is different than, say, the nuclear waste debate. But in terms of the technology. I mean, I'm sitting here right now talking to you on a phone that has lead in the circuit boards. I'm looking at my computer monitor, which has mercury in the screen. And that's just part of our daily lives. What we can do, though, is two things. One is that we formed a national campaign called the Computer Take Back Campaign to try to put pressure on the companies to take back their old products, because we think that'll lead to better design. If they have to pay for the life cycle consequences of their product, they'll pretty quickly figure out a way of designing them better. And secondly, when we do get rid of old things, if we can find a responsible way of doing that, either through reuse or recycling, then I think at least we can play a part in helping to avoid the problem that we're seeing so much around the world today.
Well, if there's danger in the elements of these products, then how can recycling work without endangering the people who engage in the process?
Well, that's a really good question, and oftentimes it does. For instance, there have been studies done of people who work in the computer recycling business, and they found high levels of these brominated flame retardants in the blood of the recycling workers. So I think that there needs to be a tremendous amount of focus on protecting the people who are part of the solution. And there are some good recyclers here in the U.S. and around the world that are trying to do a responsible job, and I think that they need to be encouraged. But it's not easy, and particularly when you're dealing with the lead itself, trying to remove the lead and then recycle that appropriately is enormously difficult and challenging. And we're down, we're down now in the U.S. to a very, very small handful of facilities that can actually do that, and with the best one in the country shut down recently. So we're actually going in the wrong direction in some ways. That's, again, because the United States Congress has refused to address these issues, and so we're developing kind of state and even city-based approaches sometimes to try to require the companies to do the right thing. But it's still very much a patchwork and still very much at the beginning.
Aren't prisoners engaged in some of this recycling as part of the Unicor program?
Yeah. I mean, we went to visit a prison here in California, a federal prison at Atwater, California, a little over a year ago, and actually saw prisoners with hammers smashing the computer monitors in a way that was very reminiscent of the pictures that we've seen from China, where poor peasants in the Chinese rural areas are doing the same thing. They're smashing the monitors with hammers. They're burning the plastic parts. Whether you're looking at exporting the problems to the third world or sticking them on some of the most defenseless people in our prisons, I think the situation is the same, that we're causing problems from the residue of the technology revolution in ways that were really unimaginable just a few years ago.
Are the prisoners made aware of the risk to their health, do you know?
Well, they haven't been, although there have been a few very outspoken people to come forward, and there's actually been a couple of prison guards that have come forward recently as whistleblowers, and this is an issue that is now percolating its way up through Attorney General Gonzalez's office with charges that this is really inhumane prison abuse, similar to some of the things we've seen in other parts of the world.
Well, who has organized the Unicor program? Is this something funded with taxpayer dollars?
Oh, absolutely. It's part of the United States prison system. It's a system that operates within the Federal Prison Bureau, and it there's hundreds, and I think actually maybe even thousands of people in federal prisons all around the country that are involved in these Unicor programs, where they get paid a few pennies an hour to disassemble computers, and they also do other things, like they make furniture and they make license plates. But the fastest growing of these programs is in the disassembly of electronic components. And again, the problem is that it's so dangerous that they figure they have prisoners do it that maybe people just won't pay attention.
Well, why would the prisons allow you to come and witness it?
Well, we were able to put enough heat on the prison system. We published a report a year or two ago called A Tale of Two Systems, where we compared the recycling operations of Hewlett-Packard and Dell. And at the time, Dell was using prison labor as part of their recycling program. They got so embarrassed that they quickly stopped it. But the prison industries continue to go, and there's people all around the country that are right now continuing to try to change their practices. There's actually legislation in Congress that's moving forward on that.
What you said earlier suggests that recycling of e-waste is not a profitable business.
Well, the way it's handled right now, you can make some money, but the cost of disassembling things is usually more than the cost that you can recover in materials. That's why we think there needs to be a change in the laws, because the market system really isn't working very well.
Well, in the recycling glass or metal products, we understand what happens. They get melted down, and then they get reused.
Right.
What would happen here if we have this lead in the circuit boards? We can't reuse those circuit boards, can we? In the end, we're going to have to do something with that lead.
That's right. I mean, eventually the lead is going to have to be removed and either retired, which is the longer-term goal, so that we're not just continuing to recycle toxics back into new products. And that's true for lead, it's true for bromine, it's true for cadmium. But again, circuit boards themselves can even be reused. Oftentimes, circuit boards have a much longer lifetime than the entire product. So again, this concept of reuse, I think, is one that we sometimes gets lost in the shuffle when people talk about recycling.
Perhaps we can just back up a moment. What happens when something gets thrown away? I see TVs and old computers out on the sidewalk waiting, trash pickups all the time.
Right.
What happens with them? They're not put into the recyclable bags. They're too big for those recycle bags.
Right. And in most cases, it's still perfectly legal to put those into the regular trash stream, and they end up in landfills. And in New York, that's the case. In California, we passed a law recently which now outlaws the landfilling of electronic products because of the concern of protecting the environment. And in several other states, they've done similar things. There's actually a law in that's been introduced in New York City that the NRDC has been involved in that is designed to try to create a whole regime for trying to attack this problem in New York City. And we're hopeful that that's going to move forward also. What you're seeing is this patchwork of states and local governments coming forward, because, again, as I said, the people in Washington just don't get it and are not doing anything to really help solve the problem.
My guest is Ted Smith, who is the founder of the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition. By the way, they have a website, svtc.org, in case you want to check them out. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You talked about American prisoners working on recycling, and you mentioned people in third world countries. What's happened to those people in China or Pakistan and India, Vietnam, who've worked in the electronics recycling industry? Has any medical examination been done on them to see whether their sperm counts have been affected, whether there have been birth defects, or whether their overall general health has been affected?
There hasn't been a lot of study, but there has been some. There's been one study that showed high rates of childhood leukemia among some of the children involved in some of these really dangerous recycling operations. I was at a conference in Beijing, China last year and met some of the other people that were presenting there who were medical doctors and researchers in the areas of China where the worst abuses are happening. And they had done some studies, again, of the children and some of the women who were experiencing reproductive problems. And they're beginning to document the human consequence of this uncontrolled end-of-life problem that we have for these electronic products. Similar stories have emerged from India and other parts of the world, as you mentioned, where a lot of the most dangerous products are ending up. But there's still nowhere near the kind of research that we need to have. And I'm sure that as that comes in more, it's going to be like in so many other cases where we're going to be able to document things, but the question is it going to really be too late by then?
We've been talking about end of life. What about beginning of life? Are there any dangers associated with the manufacture of these products?
Well, that's really how we got started. In 1982, it was discovered that there was serious groundwater contamination here in San Jose, which considers itself to be the capital of Silicon Valley. And it turned out that virtually all of the electronics manufacturing companies, and this is Intel, Advanced Micro Devices, National Semiconductor, IBM, and you name it, they were here, they were manufacturing products, they were using solvents, and the solvents leaked into our groundwater. Also, the workers who were involved in making those products started suffering high rates of miscarriages. There's been well-documented cases of both cancer and birth defects amongst the workers and their families. So this is a problem that's endemic to the whole life cycle of electronic products, and it's showing up now, as I say, in the end of life, but we've really known for 25 years or more that this is a toxic industry, and even though they call themselves the clean industry, we know that the truth is that it's really got this dark underbelly that most people sort of not aware of.
What about animal health? There's been a lot of concern expressed over increased mutations in the frog and toad populations, frogs born with deformed legs, for instance.
Right.
And then we've heard about fish with undeveloped or underdeveloped sex organs. We know that it's the result of toxic waste. Is this the toxic waste we're talking about, or is this just a tip of the iceberg?
Well, I think it's all related. I mean, some of the most alarming evidence that's really beginning to pile up is what people are calling endocrine disruption, where hormones begin to get mixed up and mimic each other, and the human body, as do the animals, take into their systems these synthetic chemicals and misperceive them as natural, and it is causing hormonal damage of proportions that I'm afraid we're going to be living with for not only the rest of our lives, for the rest of our children's lives. And again, it's in the electronics field, which is the area that I know the most about. The dynamic has been that the rush to develop the latest fad, the latest technology, means that people rush things to market, they rush it through the whole process, and they simply haven't been paying enough attention to the long-term consequences of the materials that they've been using. That's why we think that if the producers are required to become legally and financially responsible for the whole life cycle of their products, it's going to send a wake-up call that they're going to start to have to pay more attention to these long-term consequences, because they're going to feel it on their bottom line. And ultimately, that's about the only thing that most of these companies really understand is the bottom line.
Well, is it possible to find viable substitutes for these toxic chemicals, for the cadmium, the lithium, the lead, the mercury? I know that there was a lot of resistance for the drug manufacturers taking mercury out of vaccines for children because it was the most efficient way to produce clean vaccines. Now, with threats of all sorts of lawsuits because of autism, they've been forced to, but the vaccines are perhaps more vulnerable to other problems as a result.
Well, you have to do a full life cycle analysis, really, to understand the impacts. But oftentimes, and I would assert usually, people are looking at the short-term consequences rather than long-term consequences. And if you look at the longer-term consequences, even though there can be some hiccups in developing safer alternatives, almost invariably, my experience is that it makes sense to do that. And in fact, there's some good success stories where whole classes of chemicals have been phased out. Look at the chlorofluorocarbons or the freons. That's probably the greatest global success story. And again, we had tremendous resistance from all of the electronics companies here in Silicon Valley. I remember IBM saying they would have to shut down their plant here, which had over 10,000 people working there, if they couldn't use their freon. Well, lo and behold, you know, within about a year and a half to 2 years later, they had been one of the pioneers in not only phasing out the freon, they had developed a alternative process that was cheaper, it was more effective, and it was based on using soap and water as a cleaner. So, I mean, there are a significant number of success stories, but if there isn't the motivation, if there isn't the incentives, both positive and negative, provided for the companies, they're going to just continue going as business as usual.
You said that in Europe, they're way ahead of us on these recycling matters. What are they doing that we're not doing?
Well, there's two major laws that they've passed in the last few years. There's a waste electrical and electronic equipment directive, which requires the companies selling products into the European Union to be responsible for taking back old products at the end of life. And that's causing tremendous progress in terms of the company's awareness and what they're doing in terms of their recycling. And also it's having a big impact on the design. But secondly, and at least equally as important, is that there's another one called the Restriction on Hazardous Substances. And that is requiring that if you want to sell products into the European Union, you have to phase out the use of lead, cadmium, mercury, brominated flame retardants, and a couple of other very nasty substances, and that law kicks in next year. So since all global companies want to sell into the European Union, they're all going through these pretty major transformations, and they're making progress. I was just 2 weeks ago at a factory in Malaysia that makes circuit boards, and all over the factory were big signs that said this is a lead-free process. So, I mean, it is happening, but it's not happening without a lot of kicking and screaming, and it's not happening without legislation pushing it forward, and that's really, again, where the U.S. is falling behind.
Any states in the U.S. that are better than others?
Yeah, there have been now several states that have passed laws. Maine has a law modeled on the European Union. California passed a law which is a little bit different. It puts a fee on the sale of new products that's used to help pay for recycling. Minnesota is going through a very important process right now. And as I say, New York City has just introduced some very progressive legislation that we're hoping is going to help pick up the steam there.
But what happens if I have an old computer that I just have to get rid of? It's taking up room and it's not working, or an old television set. What should I do? What's the most responsible thing that I can do right now?
I would suggest if it's a computer, I would call an organization in New York City called Perscolis. I visited that place, and they have a tremendous operation going on there where they, first of all, see if they can reuse it. And they have a great program for reusing and refurbishing older equipment and getting it out to people who otherwise might not be able to afford it. So they're really dealing with a digital divide also. And they can, you can just look them up on the internet or in the phone, but Perscolis it's called. Secondly, there are some recyclers in the city of New York and in the surrounding areas, and I don't have their names in my head at the moment, but we've got them on our website, or else you could call the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, in New York City. They have an office there that's very involved. There's a man named Mark Eisman who's working very closely with us and who's very knowledgeable about these issues. So I think there are some solutions. You have to go out of your way to find them is the problem. And I remember not very long ago in San Jose, if you wanted to recycle cans and bottles, you had to drive halfway across town to the one place that would take them. But now, since it's convenient, we have very high rates of recycling, and I think that's the model that we've got to get to in electronics.
Meanwhile, people can check you out on that website that you mentioned, svtc.org. Perscolis spelled P-E-R-S-C-O-L-I-S?
S-C-H-O-L-A-S.
And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Ted Smith is the founder of the Silicon Valley Toxic Coalition.
Leonard, if I could just say at the closing, too, there's another website called the computertakeback.com where we have a lot of the information about the national campaign, the Computer Takeback campaign.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.